She's here in spirit.
She can see me.
Yeah, I'm very self-conscious. For some reason, when you guys are looking at me, it's okay, but all of a sudden I'm on a digital camera and I get nervous. Okay. All right. So welcome to another meeting of the LaRouche Youth Movement of Canada and the Committee for the Republic of Canada. Before JP gets into the class going through the last days of Socrates, I'm going to just set the tone a little bit, as we usually try to do in having these little political briefings, to get people in the right context and frame of mind, such that we'll better understand the consequences of Socrates' life and the political and cultural world that he was trying to create and fix in his day, and be better capable of acting today in ours. So I thought what might be a good idea would be to go through quickly just a brief introduction for those listening at home, and well as most of you here have a certain idea. But what makes LaRouche and this movement unique internationally as both a political strategist, an economic thinker, scientist, and a statesman, is his unending work at defending the role of the mind as the active driving principle of not just human society, but the universe as a whole. And this is really important when we here are trying to remedy the crises that are currently hitting the world, to be able to take into account that the system as a whole, which is currently collapsing, is not just another word. It's not a series, or it's not just a, because people say the word system a lot, you know, for all sorts of things, and they have a certain abstract idea of what this means. You know, there's certain, you know, economic agreements and rules and things that we live by, but it's not a very, like, tangible concept for most people. So the consideration that what you have to deal with as a system, first of all, is that, yes, you are dealing with a series of different rules and economic policies and a variety of things, but the idea is there's a oneness to it. There's a certain unique concept, like a unity, where there are these many things and qualities about it, but that act together as a one. So that it tends to be the case that whenever we're looking at, you know, you could take in nature, you have ecosystems, solar systems, you've got nervous systems, that every component within those systems doesn't conflict with the working of the whole. But the working of the whole can't be known by just trying to analyze the individual parts of the system, right? So there's a certain conception there that there's a harmony of variables that work together. Now what drives these is because when you're dealing with human beings, the systems that we create are done unlike that of the planet, which can't really choose to do something other than be a planet or what have you. The circulatory system won't choose to do anything else. It's going to be arranged largely by the, you know, all sorts of astronomical cycles, biological cycles. But with a human being, you have free will. And in that sense, the ideas governing how the system functions, be it right or wrong ideas about how the universe works, is going to largely determine the capacity for that system to function successfully. And for what reasons, you know? So if we're looking at things like the collapse of the global economic system, then what we really have to look at are what are those ideologies, the ideas, the minds that are shaping, for better or for worse, how the system unfolds. And it's really important to keep that in mind, because LaRouche is going to be giving a webcast on Saturday internationally, which is going to be of historic significance. It's the second one of 2010. And we have to make sure that this is listened to, and people both at home and on the web everywhere tune into this and get a sense of what his message is and take it to heart, because he's announced that the time has now officially come for us to shift gears. And this is what he's going to do in this webcast, to prepare to blow out the system. And I'm not talking violently here, but what we have is that what seeming stability we currently have in the global monetary system, which did collapse back in 2007 in July, after LaRouche's July 25th webcast, has been the simple thing holding together is the false perception, the maintenance of consistent lies that it's somehow viable. And so LaRouche blew the whistle on this back at the beginning of February for the first time and went on the attack by exposing the fact that the Banco Santander and the entire basis of the euro system was unviable and it was about to collapse. Mm-hmm. And subsequently what we've seen, in fact, has been a complete disintegration of the entire euro system, which began with Greece, certain few nations that defaulted on their state debts, but that have continued to collapse. But that now all of the banks, what are called the inter-alpha banks, inter-alpha group of major banks controlled by the Rothschilds, are all holding on to unpayable debts. The assets that they consider to be profitable assets on their balance sheets, they don't actually exist. And so LaRouche exposed this back at the beginning of February. The second aspect of things is that Kisha's victory in Texas is uniquely one of the most historic events that have also occurred in recent history, which has completely changed the game as a whole. And it's not self-evident for a lot of people who don't think in terms of what we'd mentioned before about the role of the intervention of individual human minds which shape systems. But that's going to become more apparent as my briefing progresses. Now, the nature of the current or the recent month and a bit since the exposure of the fallacious assets on the bank's books of Banco Santander and others has been rooted primarily in recognizing that the Brazilian carry trade is the basis by which we've created what's called fictitious capital. So hundreds of untold trillions of dollars have been created in the recent year through the scheme of literally just creating money by going into nations where speculators and different investment banks have been taking out huge amounts of loans from nations that offer a very low interest rate on their state bonds and what have you, and then go to Brazil to reinvest them into the Brazilian market that offers about 9% or greater returns on those investments. So we've got huge amounts of money that's just been created out of nothing. Nothing's been produced. The quality of life of the Brazilians is being destroyed. All of the nations of Europe, of the Middle East, of Asia, of America, which have their state assets also locked up into the global speculative markets, are suffering as a byproduct, as we see with Greece, as we see with a lot of the United States states, which are increasingly bankrupt, with Canada to a varying degree. And another aspect have been, and this is a key one that's been in the media, especially this past week, are these things called derivatives, or specifically a type of derivative called a credit default swap. Right? You guys ever heard of a credit default swap? You have, judging from your smile.
I've heard of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like something you do in the back alleys of school at recess or something.
Yeah, right. Something you should feel very ashamed about when you get caught, if you get caught doing it. the nature of these things, and these make up about $40 trillion of the global economy, are essentially bets on bets that will default. So that's right. It's as crazy as it sounds. Whole nations now, whole companies who have taken on huge sums of unpayable usurious debts have had it. There's been certain financial speculators who have been clever enough to, or stupid enough, to think it was a good idea to consider these debts now securities that they could gamble upon and leverage, such that now we have these credit default swaps in the scale of, like I said, $40 trillion. And they're one of the biggest or weakest links of the global economy. Now, the whole global economy, you could say, is one giant weak link. But these are especially a disgusting form of cyanide as a poison sitting there. So what's interesting now is that after LaRouche has blown the whistle and exposed this to all of the different heads of state, union leaders, media outlets around the world, along with the organization that we represent, which is running candidates in France, 92 Strong, Germany, in the States, and getting this message out there, has been that a new variable has been introduced into the dynamic, where up until now, the populations of the world who have sort of had to have gone along, it's not like there was an absence of a desire for change, for something better from the people, but there was an absence of an ability to see through what the cause of the crisis was, let alone the remedies for the necessary solutions. So now that the word has gotten out that the fault of the bankruptcies of these nations is not the nation's fault per se, the way that people have been led to believe by a lot of the financial media and other things, it's sort of a guilt trip, you know, like you got to accept the cuts that the European Central Bank is trying to impose on you, Grecian people, because your nation has just been bad. So because you've sinned, you have to accept cuts in healthcare. But now that lie can't be maintained. And so you have, for the first time now, a huge impulse on the part of the population and different leadership circles who now have the confidence to see that there is a higher reason for this happening, and who are standing up to things that they wouldn't even have thought closely to stand up to months ago, which we saw manifesting very heavily. And I'll read some of the a couple of key stats that just popped out of the paper, which is that the population in Greece has just voted by 80% to say in opposition to the cuts that the European Central Bank is demanding upon them. Now, this is a huge change from not just, I mean, some a month and a half ago, a lot of the media that was talking about the sentiment of the Greek people was that they were saying, you know, this would be the best thing for Greece is to just be fiscally, you know, sound, to reduce our huge irresponsible debt down to that 3% that the European Central Bank wants us to. And that was the general sentiment that was being manipulated, whereas that's completely shifted gears now. That's gone. On a side note, you have Iceland that's just, the people have just organized, different union leaders and whatnot, have organized a referendum to give the shaft to the British, to the City of London banks, which have been demanding upon Iceland, which has been perpetually bankrupt for a long time, that they have to accept, the population of Iceland has to accept paying back all of the state defaults that the Iceland government went through when they couldn't pay back the loans that were made to them by the British banks. So the British banks were trying to like hold a trigger to the head of the people, which the Iceland government even voted for, saying that, yeah, we'll pay off, we'll make the population pay. We will do it because it's, you know, we got it. So you had every single variable saying that this was going to go down. And this is in the scale of a few hundred billion. And the population just had a referendum saying, no, we're 80%, 90% of the population all said that they were not going to pay. That we're going to repeal the arrangement made by their parliament. Top this off now, and you realize that the amount of pressure that's being put on the representatives across Europe has manifested in very unlikely things, like the fact that you've had now the heads of state, who largely are not very good people. You've had Nicolas Sarkozy, for example, the president of France, of Germany, Angela Merkel, the president of Greece, Papandreou, and the president of Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Juncker. Who, these guys are—they're not nice people. They're, you know, by any measure. So it's a surprise to see that they've just come out. The Financial Times of Germany has just produced a report showing that these four heads of state came out with a letter demanding that the head of the European Union, Barroso, basically eliminate these credit default swaps. That, and set up an investigation to look through the banks to see what the assets are on the basis of what are the unviable assets, what are represented in these credit default swaps, which, as we said earlier, were just these disgusting non-existent pieces of monopoly money, or worse. So you do have a movement. You can't assume that this is like the heads of state acting on necessarily just their own volition. It's kind of against their character. But you have to see this as generally a movement, a push for survival within the governing institutions, the layers of academia, of government, within all of these nations, who don't want to die. They don't want to get sucked down. Now, in opposition to this letter, you have the Inter-Alpha banks that are freaking out. So all of the representatives of the Inter-Alpha group are all, you know, screaming their heads off. It's kind of expected. And the Wall Street Journal also pointed out that Barack Obama and his team are also in opposition to the proposal to investigate the CDOs. Mm-hmm. And of course, why not, right? I mean, his whole team is owned by Goldman Sachs, so it's kind of lawful. And the British reaction is also interesting because you have this, the Financial Services Agency chief, Lord Adair Turner, who's also one of the directors of the Bank of International Settlements, the thing that brought you Hitler and Mussolini in the 1930s, who has been quoted as saying, the collateralized debt, the credit default swaps sales are not the main cause of the sovereign debt, so just let them be. That's it. The CDS sales are not the main cause of the sovereign debt, so just let them be.
They're fragile, you know.
It's Greece. It's the nations. Yeah, just let it be. Yeah. Got to learn from John Lennon. So this is stirring up a lot of shit right now in the international oligarchical community, and all of their cells really don't know how to deal with this. Because it's not part of their game plan. They didn't, you know, when you start developing a god complex, you sort of think that the world sort of like bows beneath the whim of your will. And when you discover that the universe doesn't actually correspond to how you want it to be, sometimes you have a temper tantrum, which is now what we're getting across the board. In the States now, a similar effect from the interventions by LaRouche and Keisha Rogers has been, well, what we have in the States is a very similar, in many ways, but different problem that we've seen with a lot of the European states that are going bust. In that, while on the one hand, the states of the U.S. mostly are bankrupt, on the other hand, there's a greater potential in the form of government and economic system and culture that exists within the United States location that you don't have, that's absent generally from Europe. And you do have people, generally what we've seen now is a trend where increasingly those who are predisposed to patriotism, both from Democrat and Republican alike, are making a certain stand against this push, this increasing push towards fascism that we've been getting sucked into. You have people like Elliot Spitzer, Rangel, both of whom, and many others, you could go through Kucinich and a list of, and see them literally being created almost by the day, some of whom are also being taken out of the picture. But many of these individuals are being targeted by slander campaigns, people like Rangel died.
Murtha died.
John Conyers, who's the one who was slandered and taken off the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Rangel. Fake little petty scandals have been created and blown up in the media to make sure that anybody who represents a tendency to move with LaRouche and with a Franklin Roosevelt orientation have been completely attacked. Rangel has been forced to resign as the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee about a month and a half ago. We have Spitzer, who has had a record of standing up against these Wall Street banks, who's the former governor of New York, who, again, you know, a little sex scandal never hurt to take somebody out of office, and a manifold others. The newest one, which is worthwhile for us to pay attention to right now, because it's indicative of the intention going on for the whole of the United States right now, is the push to take down Governor David Patterson of New York, who replaced Elliot Spitzer not that long ago. Now, David Patterson, for all of his faults, he has stood up to various measures against a lot of the interests on Wall Street and a lot of their push to parasitically just take infinite money from bailout and do all sorts of other crazy shit. The danger is that there's a push on the part of people like Felix Rohatyn, who's a longtime enemy of LaRouche and has got a long history of killing people by virtue of imposing fascist economic policies, both in New York in the 1970s and in other nations like Chile. He put out a demand in all of the press in New York to install this guy, Richard Ravitch, who's, I think, the deputy general, or the lieutenant general of New York, as governor to replace Patterson in this fake scandal that's been just blown up by the media. Now, Richard Ravitch has already stated that his intention is to completely cut down all deficits by taking the budget axe to all social programs, following in the trail of Schwarzenegger. So he's already said that he's committed to $9.5 billion of cuts in what he calls structural balance, to bring things down to a structural balance. The sketchy thing is, while he's calling for no more borrowing, no more irresponsible borrowing to, you know, pay for things like state needs and stuff, he has called for, just like Schwarzenegger did, $2 billion a year to be borrowed by from Wall Street in order to give in the form of stimulus and bailout for 3 years. So while you're not actually, you're committing that you're not going to take out any loans to pay for things that are useful, you will take out loans to pay for things like, or just to print money to give to banks. You know.
He's saying he's going to borrow money from Wall Street?
Wall Street banks. Wall Street banks to print money to bail out different institutions from whatever needs a bailout, basically. And the third aspect, which is where another very important variable of the fascism really comes out, is his demand to create, and also Rohatyn's demand, who's his main controller, to create a financial review board with executive power. Because who else is going to enforce these policies? Is it going to be some elected representative who's elected by the people? Are the people going to elect some elected representative to make the cuts that are going to kill them? So this is the same thing that Obama was pushing with his independent advisory boards, whose job it was to be outside of government to make these bloody cuts and to make the hard decisions that just have to be made, right? So on the macro and microcosm, these ideas of imposing the will of a few onto the many at the behest of an oligarchy is coming through very heavily. This is the same shit that Mussolini and Hitler did in both aspects. Now, the population's watching this, right? They're seeing that every state is either nearly bankrupt or completely bankrupt. Illinois most recently just announced the cutting of 13,000 teachers, which is almost half of their education system, from being supported for lack of funds. Now, all of these teachers come from inner city. Maybe one or two, but most of the schools being shut down are all inner city schools. It's the same thing we've got with Detroit, that's committed to literally sever its own leg to try to save blood, where the governor or the mayor of Detroit has called to contract the city, since there's so many neighborhoods that are completely, you know, like 1,000 homes sold for a dollar or something like that, or some huge number of homes sold for a dollar in Detroit last year. Mm-hmm. And you have just complete neighborhoods, and that kills property value, first of all. But you have whole neighborhoods that are just crackhead neighborhoods of squat houses that are completely unlivable. So now, because of this collapse of the foreclosures and lack of jobs, now he's saying, well, rather than spend the money to try to cover this huge terrain, most of it's unlivable, we're going to try to encourage people to move into the core of Detroit, right? Move out of their homes and just... It's kind of like your body shutting down. You think of somebody going through, you know, who's falling in cold water, whose body is shutting down, and, you know, just to maintain vital life support functions, the limbs give out and all the blood goes to maintain the core. It's kind of like the same kind of crazy logic. So anyhow, you've got the population watching this happening in all regards, California, Illinois, Detroit, you've got this in New York, in every state, the population is getting completely destroyed, and they're seeing their president, who, you know, we all saw what he offered, is going around in a desperate last-ditch attempt to save his health care bill. His Nazi healthcare bill, and people know this, by saying that we need, in his last speech just yesterday in Missouri, He said that the federal government should pay private contractors to basically provide a surveillance on the activities of all doctors and hospitals who treat Medicare patients. Now, the way that these headhunters basically would be getting paid was pretty much as a percentage of the profit that the state would no longer have to pay to those doctors who would be covering Medicare patients. Yeah. The name for it is recovery audit collectors. That's the official name that he wants to call these things.
RACs.
RACs. Yeah.
Just to clarify, but you're talking about a group of people that will check doctors to see if they don't spend too much? Is that the idea?
Yes.
What's the name again?
They are recovery audit collectors. Because there's a lot of doctors who have this stupid thing called a heart, and they want to go over their allotted quota of Medicare fees that they can allot to their patients.
These guys will all be outfitted with full helmets, this little visor for looking, huge guns.
Robocop. Well, like Judge Dredd.
You are over.
I am the law. So you got. So this is insane. Now. Keisha comes out in Texas as a Democrat with an $8,000 budget calling for a campaign that involves impeach Obama, save NASA, effectively take down Wall Street. That's it. That's her campaign. Loud and clear. You know, there's no ambiguities there. And with an $8,000 budget and an active presence where she's the only person who's actually saying something of substance, she got 53% of the vote. The other two Democrats that she was fighting against in these Democratic primaries, each one got something like 20%, or 23 and 22%. So this is a landslide and a statistical impossibility, considering that, you know, well, whatever. Let's just say if you were a gambling person, you wouldn't have bet on that happening. But LaRouche knew that it was going to happen because it had to happen. And LaRouche is not a statistician. One of the key things about beginning to look at the world from the standpoint of the mind as a governing principle and what physical principles are governing the actions and trajectory of your system is that you have to know something about reality in the population, and that people are not just, they're not just little numbers on a roulette table. They don't just behave the way that they statistically behaved in every single election previous to this. People act in accordance with the reality that they face when they wake up in the morning. And there's a certain tension, when there's a certain tension that's being created in the world through the collapse of a system in which people live, the ability for them, and LaRouche is very explicit on this, the ability for the people to absorb and seek out the necessary ideas for their survival is amplified in ways that it would never be in times of relative comfort. And so this is what he commissioned Keisha, our other candidates in Boston and California, Summer and Rachel, to campaign on and to tap into, because the danger is that without that leadership, and in a time of a mass strike where the people don't accept being shat on anymore, if there is no leadership, you will get bloody Jacobin mob. Right? There's nothing. So what we have to do, our function is really to channel that rage into something constructive, and to make sure that it's not blind rage, but that there's a specific positive, not something that you're just fighting against. Oh, evil people want to take my health care, or, you know. It's not just something you're fighting against, but there's a positive vision of where you see the world in 50 or 100 years. All right. And then knowing that from that vantage point that was supplied to you by, that's the role of leadership, that's what Lincoln does, or Martin Luther King, or us, what LaRouche does, by supplying people the necessary vision, being able to then see what obstacles are standing in their way and what needs to be corrected to achieve that end becomes possible. if you don't have the end and you just try to chop the heads off of a hydra, you're never going to get anywhere, which is the main problem with a lot of single-issue do-gooders right now in this world, is that they don't think dynamically. They're not thinking about a whole system as a process, of which they themselves must intervene on. So Keisha did that. That was one impossible event. We have to get several more, or a series of other impossible, statistically impossible events to occur over the subsequent weeks and months ahead. But this is a very good start. Now, to end on, I guess, a bit of a positive note before I kick off to JP, on an international level now, there's a whole new ballgame forming. You've got a call for the Bretton Woods, which is being made on the part of the Greek president, Papandreou, of which, of course, up until now, the only person calling for the Bretton Woods since 1994, or new Bretton Woods monetary system, has been LaRouche. He's joined his voice into it, albeit a slightly more impotent version, but still, it's a step in the right direction. The President Sarkozy, who again, it's shocking to a lot of people who know the character of this guy to see what he's been coming up with. He's recently announced as well his support for international development from the standpoint of nuclear energy. Now, the speech he had recently given at a major international conference organized by the OECD and the International Atomic Energy Association, he said, I quote, and this is again indicative of not him himself, but the people around him, and I quote, "We have entered a new nuclear era, that of its renaissance. The analogy with the glorious period of European history some 500 years ago will undoubtedly provoke some debates. But there are common elements. The questioning of ancient beliefs and irrational fears and faith in science and technology." He goes on to attack in this the British Malthusian crusade, who's otherwise pushing for global population reduction, by saying, "World population is growing, and the energy needs of our planet are growing as well. The ideologies calling for reversing growth and progress offer no solutions. The solution lies in diversification, rationalization, and scientific and technological progress. Let us put aside the stereotypes and suspicions of ulterior motives. The countries of the world are not divided between those with nuclear technology, jealousy guarding their privileges, and those demanding a right that the others are denying them. On the contrary, I think that nuclear power can be the cement that binds a new form of global solidarity." So he is outright attacking, in this speech at least, we'll see how much he follows through in action, the British Malthusian freaks, who indeed have had the ideology of technological apartheid, and that only a few nations do get the right to frontier technologies, energy, and things of that sort, whereas the majority have to stay in a state of appropriate technologies, using things that don't, you know, elevate their quality of life or allow them to do too much work because, you know, it's part of their culture to not have technology. And that's the general, like, idea and excuse for keeping Africa and India and all these other nations in a state where they have to burn wood and manure and not have access to these basic forms of technology that all of us get to enjoy. To the degree that we stop investing in it, then we don't, but whatever. That's neither here nor there. The other element of things is that, because this goes hand in hand with what LaRouche is calling for in terms of not just the Bretton Woods, but the global Glass-Steagall. Now, one thing I neglected to mention, but in the United States, there has been a bill introduced for a real Glass-Steagall. Not the Paul Volcker kind, but the real Glass-Steagall, that calls for an immediate separation of banking functions from commercial investment and insurance banking. That was, as people know, the first step that Roosevelt needed to undertake in order to put the system through a general type of reorganization and bankruptcy in the 1930s.
When you say Glass-Steagall, is that like an idea for a system to be implemented?
No, it's what it is. It's a bill that was created in 1933 by two senators, one named Senator Glass, a Democrat, and the other one, Stegall, who is a Republican. And they worked with Roosevelt, and they created this legislation to say all of the banks that speculated with other people's monies in the 1920s that created the Great Depression, they could no longer do that. And that in order to get the government to intervene and organize what was worth saving in the banks and what was to be, you know, just shot in the garbage to create the New Deal, you had to first pass that law to give the government the authority to do so. And that was repealed by in 1999 by Larry Summers, the guy who's Obama's main economics guru. So this bill was introduced now in the United States, which goes hand in hand with the global Glass-Steagall that LaRouche called for, saying that it's not just one nation, but this it was done in the United States, but it's compatible with every nation. So we need a general global Glass-Steagall, which implies also for Canadian banks as well. So it's something that you will want to study a little bit more about. The second element of this is that this financial overhaul, the overhaul of the structure of the financial system is necessary to the degree that we can get back onto real economics. And this is what nations from India, China, and Russia, who are all part of LaRouche's Four Powers Alliance with the United States, are recognizing increasingly and making policy. Whereas what we've seen now is China has just announced to extend its high-speed rail to go through 17 nations, including down into the Middle East, into Jordan, and up into Russia. And we're talking high-speed rail here of 250 miles an hour or more. And this would be done in about approximately 10 years if the British don't try to explode something.
No guarantees there.
Yeah. You have this Paris conference, international conference on access to civil engineering, had a very interesting series of speakers, one of whom was India's Atomic Energy Association chairman, Sri Kumar Banerjee, who gave an interesting presentation on the mandate for India, who has already made agreements to begin constructing five nuclear parks and made similar arrangements to extend its cooperation with Russia, which are already in the scale of $10 billion a year, up double that over the course of the coming 10 years for fast breeder nuclear power reactors and other things. Now, what he said is that if we can get, and we can get, but as soon as we tap into fourth generation nuclear power reactors of the fast breeder variety, we can get energy resources attainable easily for the next 155,000 years. Both because the quality of power that you get from fourth generation is about 1,000 times greater from anything you get from any other form of nuclear energy. Yeah. And nothing is wasted. So on top of that, putting together by closing the fuel cycle, everything becomes recyclable. And that's not even accounting things like thermonuclear fusion, which if we're committed to going in this direction, we're going to get people will harness nuclear fusion in no time whatsoever. So 155,000 years, that's not bad.
That's just fission?
Huh?
That's just the fission technology?
That's just fission technology, yeah. It's taking thorium, that's the thorium fuel cycle. How many million dollars? Lots of millions of dollars. Lots.
Plenty for everybody.
Yeah.
But 155,000 years in terms of the amount of energy available with that system.
Right.
150,000 years?
Yeah.
Wow, that's
interesting to see.
Is 150,000 years of energy of nuclear fission
with thorium?
Yeah.
If you
fourth generation nuclear fuel sources with thorium as a fuel source? Yeah.
Thorium.
Thorium.
Yeah.
Thorium.
Yes.
Thorium fourth generation.
Yeah. Now, the important thing about this, these developments, and there are more, many more, is that they represent a complete break from globalization, from the push by the Rothschilds, the British Empire, to impose this otherwise Orwellian society of this whole one world government. That shit, everything involved with that is incompatible with everything we're seeing happening now coming out of the Eurasian landmass. Mm-hmm. So this represents a whole new field of potentials that have to be tapped into and capitalized upon now. Looking now towards Canada, LaRouche gave a very important speech at the conference that we hosted in 2007, where LaRouche gave a general overview for Canadians to fight for, to have a certain both short and long-term vision for what we need our nation to do in order to play an active and you'd want to play a useful role in these positive developments. Now, the key is the development of the North. Any type of development that we get in Africa, all of the needs for huge infrastructure projects around the world that'll be necessary for a space colonization program, for the water and food needs for the world, one of the best places for that is the Canadian North. But to get that, we need a lot of energy. And this is why it's necessary. It's possible. It's necessary for mankind to do it. But we can't get it with wind and solar. It's impossible to get the type of energy to do the work to develop the north of Canada with the types of energy sources being played with by a lot of these monetarist, fetishist freaks who are being being sold on the line by the green movement. We need nuclear energy. It's not even just a choice of one clean energy versus another. It's really a mandate for mankind. So yeah.
Are you saying that we need to have more nuclear energy in Canada to develop more?
Yeah.
In order to eventually help colonize this place, right?
Everything, yeah.
But why specifically the North?
Oh, because we have the greatest source of mineral wealth untapped that's anywhere in existence on the planet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the least amount per capita of development, considering we have the second biggest nation in the world, and a population that's smaller than, like, California. these are the types of things. If we actually want to get back into reality, we have to think about, doing these types of projects that used to be a normal, commonplace thing for people to do, like build something that will be there for your grandchildren. And that'll also give Canadians an ability to finally grow up, get out of this mother-dominated womb that we've been in under the British for way too long. Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, that's it, because as it stands, we can't run a campaign like they are in the United States with the form of government that we have. Because as soon as you try within the channels that exist currently for the population to work with, to go against a policy by, let's say you're a liberal and you're going against the policy by the liberal government, or conservative going against the policy of your party, you're out of a job. So the system as a whole, on one level, is designed to be incompetent. On a second level, even if a nation does do something in Canada under a parliamentary system that's of any relevance, you have whole slews of things of people like the Governor General, and whole slews of other unelected, jerks, whose job it is to make sure that nothing potent actually gets done. Which is why if you look at the House of Commons debates that happen any day of the week, they're insane. Nothing is being said. it's actually just a big kindergarten shouting match. So these have to change if we're actually going to have a society that's sovereign and a world community of sovereign nation states the way the founding fathers of the U.S. and LaRouche intended. So that's one thing I would throw out would be we have French and English versions of LaRouche's speech in Ottawa that I mentioned briefly. It'd be a good idea for all Canadians to really just take this in and get a certain sense of the higher standpoint that he called out for. And we've got a whole list of a whole box full in the back. But I guess I'll take questions or just leave for... Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question concerning... You know where you were talking about the government wanting to move the population into the core?
Yeah, of Detroit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What does it gain from doing that?
You have to pay less sanitation employees and garbage pickers and,
Really?
City maintenance. You could take off, I guess you could shut down street grids, like electricity grids that you don't have to maintain now.
If you want to kill people, it's good to herd them together first before you send the gas.
I understand that part, but what's the goal?
I've seen people, Michael Moore's moving there. The investors actually buying houses, like the whole seat of houses, speculation, and selling loud.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah.
When you say that they're shut down from whatever infrastructures or start deteriorating the system, how exactly should we remedy to this default? Like, should we invest in science or, you know, how could we develop, instead of cutting in, you know, whatever healthcare infrastructures or, you know, cutting in certain budgets or certain areas of the country, how exactly should we remedy to this problem? Would it be physical economy or energy, technology? What's the
mm-hmm.
solution?
Yeah.
Instead of, I'm saying, instead of cutting in and healthcare or whatever, how could we fix the problem?
Well, it starts by saying the truth. You have to say the truth very loudly. And that's the main thing holding people back right now,
mm-hmm.
is the, you know, the fear and intimidation to break from the giant delusion that everyone believes, which is somehow the system can save itself, which is irrational. But you have to say the truth, which is that, yeah, it's bankrupt. And as soon as you say that, like a heroin addict or anybody who wants to get clean, after they admit that they have a problem, they can start rehabilitation processes, you know? But the idea is, yeah, I mean, start from the standpoint of what's true, work from that point, vantage point, and do what's necessary to save what's real, since we live in reality.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, it's obviously there's more to internalize in so that you can deploy it, but, I mean, you want to have the conception that that right now, there's certain real needs for mankind, right? There's certain truthful laws and principles governing human existence within the universe. And based upon that, we're going in certain, there's certain directions that we can generally, we can foresee the consequences of today's behavior and thinking, right? So knowing that the universe is going in certain directions, there's certain possible futures, you know, that could be created. What you want to do is to think what's necessary and what's possible, and anything that is not necessary, let it fall. And things that are necessary and are possible, well, anything necessary is possible.
So
you should think to just do that.
What I'm asking exactly is that instead of letting the infrastructure, the roads, the sewers,
sure.
the water system to deteriorate, how should we not only perfect these infrastructure and systems, but how will we construct? Is it through economy? Is it through
good
government?
Well, let Meredith wants to handle this.
Well, you know, the way you're asking the question, maybe you're thinking about it in the wrong way. To me, it seems to me that there's no such thing as cutting your infrastructure, cutting your education, and cutting your health care, and having a recovery at the same time. We're so used to thinking in terms of saving money, but that's not the point at all. You know, one thing that LaRouche stresses over and over again is that money doesn't have any value. And so the question from that is, okay, what does have value?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at economy the way that LaRouche does, economics is actually physical, right? And the most basic part of your economy is the health of your population. You have to create the situation whereby people's certain basic needs are met in such a way that they are able to do their more important work, which is to actually contribute to something creative, which is your economy. People's contributions are your economy. Every single new idea that's able to be contributed by every single person is actually contributes to the actual wealth generation, right? And people can't do this under conditions where they are swamped with stress and bills because they can't pay for their health care, where you know their health and their you know their cost of living is skyrocketing, their basic you know standard of living is deteriorating, right? If you have that situation, then you're back to what we were at before, which is like hunting and gathering food. You're spending your whole time on the most basic needs, and you have no time for those higher creative questions. And if that happens, then the very means by which you're able to step up to another level of existence is cut off. So healthcare is something that cannot be compromised. You know, the question is, what can you do to actually create the wealth that's going to support your healthcare and your education, right? How can you ensure a greater and greater amount of free energy for exactly those purposes? How can you make those things simultaneously cheaper per person and superior in terms of quality per person? So you're actually getting more at less cost per person. And so the types of things that LaRouche is calling for, which is, you know, your infrastructure, your agriculture, and your industry, have to actually be done. And what supports that, I mean, first of all, you have to get rid of the monetary system, because the monetary system relies upon bleeding exactly those things to support this fictitious game, which we call, you know, the free market, globalization. If you're able to do that, then you can actually start doing what he's calling for, which is creating sovereign credit as an order of law for the purposes of creating that infrastructure. And if you can do that, then that's what actually pays for the system.
Okay.
But you must minus the stealing. If you're trying to create all this stuff and people are just taking buckets of your free energy in the form of money out of the system, if they, you know, mm-hmm. if you're allowed
to be able to support that system, which is
in actual fact, the way that economics actually works is that if you do these things, you actually create more and more free energy per capita in the system. So actually, the investment in your infrastructure and your healthcare, incidentally, actually generates
things,
wealth.
Okay, so these things are closely entwined at the economy, the infrastructure, the institution, mm-hmm. healthcare system, all of this is all intertwined to one another, and you have to develop a certain a better comprehension of these things in order to generate a better wealth.
Yeah, and stop thinking about trying to save money.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering, because what they're doing right now in the United States is they're cutting in healthcare, they're cutting in infrastructure, institutions, and I was wondering how, instead of cutting in how do we generate a better wealth, a better construction?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, that's generally it. I mean,
yeah.
It's physical economy. Yeah, the economy is physical. Yeah. Yeah. Chippy, want to go?
Félicitations, j'ai utilisé. Je vais te montrer, mais il n'y a pas de temps.